I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren.
And we are the Rance Macabre, covering all things horror.
With every episode, we explore the genre with sharp focus and deep production.
We want you to love scary movies as much as we do, so we don't overshare plots or give spoilers. Welcome back, listeners.
Hey, it's been a while.
It has been. We last talked to you last month, but big things have happened since then.
Yeah, well, we happened to win the Save Horror Madness.
Out of nowhere.
Wild turnaround. We were losing until we won.
I know, I was very confused by that, but then I thought, Dawn knows what's going on. Dawn at Women in Caskets. I'm not going to question it. I'm just going to take the win.
Maybe it's a trick. Maybe they have us on their show and to humiliate us. Like, that's the that's the big surprise.
Like, J/K, you guys were dead last the entire time. was
Now we're going to talk about what we want to talk about. But yeah, no, it'll be fun to do a sort of unexpected victory lap.
Yes.
Around the Women in Caskets podcast, Miskatonic Musings, and the Test Pattern podcast with Tab and Jacob.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to have to figure out some stuff we want to talk about, aside from ourselves.
I love talking about myself. That's why we have a podcast.
But maybe we'll continue the theme of talking about everybody's favorite horror scores as this episode. I'm sure the listeners already read the description of the episode. This is part one of The Sounds of Horror. I think we're going in casual this time around. We're kind of covering some bases, and we're certainly inspired by a couple pieces of news. It was recently announced that John Carpenter is going to be scoring the Halloween reboot. Well, it's not a reboot, it's a continuation. Danny McBride and David Gordon Green, who's directing. So the duo from Eastbound and Down and Vice Principals. I like them a lot.
Yes. It's now apparently a zanier Halloween.
Is it? No.
No, I don't know. I was just saying that. Because of them being involved, how can they not be funny?
Well,
they're hilarious.
Well, I wouldn't describe the things as zany, but yeah, no, they are, and it's got an edge to it. I like, so I guess because Blumhouse is producing it, they've been giving updates in terms of like production wrapping pretty recently. There's certainly been stills from the set where Jamie Lee Curtis. I don't love the sort of crazy lady old hair, long
Me
hair
either.
That she's
I
sporting.
I expect my Jamie Lee Curtis to have a very short pixie cut.
Yes.
I enjoy that. That's what I want to see.
Shapes her face nicely.
It does. It really does. But this is like crazy scraggle hair.
Yeah.
Which makes sense.
It sounds like there is a certainly like weathered, everybody's been put through the ringer kind of tone to this next one.
I can't imagine Lori is like really thinking about her conditioner.
She's got what home self-defense priorities is she?
Yeah.
I keep hearing sort of conflicting ideas. I've heard that this is meant to be the only official continuation of the series, so going from the very original from 78 to this one, which
so then
I'm
saying nothing
John
ever
Carpenter.
Happened in between,
right? That's
But,
the assumption.
Okay. So just pretend like two never existed the next day.
Right. Well, yeah, that's the strangest element because it's like the continued night of.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We'll see how it goes. I'm looking forward to it. It's very exciting that John Carpenter is scoring it. It certainly shows that like he's liking what he sees.
Right.
It's got his seal of approval. And John Carpenter has certainly been touring his ass off and playing music. So like he's certainly in the right headspace. And we're going to talk about Carpenter's music a little bit later. But yeah, I don't know. I'm excited. I really dig this series overall.
I do not. So, no, I mean, I'll probably watch it.
You don't like Michael Myers or Jason for that matter. Not really your speed.
No.
Okay. So the other piece of news that certainly shocked me to hear, and this was on the radio, it was that physical media is making a comeback. CDs and vinyl are outselling digital downloads for the first time since 2011.
I feel like that's fake news.
I think it's also probably symbolic that digital downloads are coming down as well. I think between whatever, people illegally downloading, but people consume music in all sorts of different ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Spotify probably doesn't count as like a digital download. It's
That's true.
Streaming. So like streaming services are certainly, you know, biting into that. And so the actual direct sale you know, where money goes to the musicians, it's balancing out between physical media and digital downloads. And certainly a lot of credit is due to, like, vinyl releases as it relates to horror soundtracks. Waxworks and Mondo are certainly, like, they're true believers. Like, whenever they put out vinyl, they bust their ass to, like, produce beautiful album sleeves. Right. And, like, that, I miss that.
That is something I really miss about. I used to love album art.
Yeah.
I love looking at the, and also the lyrics, everything. You'd have everything in there. Love that.
And that it had surface area where, like, you know, I liked a CD book, but it's, I don't know, it's like a greeting card. It's kind of like there's not, you know, there's not substance to it. There's not really depth. And so, yeah, with an LP, like, you got, you know, 12 inches by 12 inches to decorate and really produce some pretty cool art. And so, yeah, it's funny that there are a bunch of music collectors in the New York horror movie group that their commitment to, like, pre-sales and buying things, like, as they, like, it was recently, what, Record Store Day?
Mm-hmm.
I think 2 weeks ago now. And these are the guys who are lining up for, like, the special release, the, like, obscure, you know, sort of maybe pre-release at times that they make things available that... I don't have that kind of commitment. I can't do it.
I don't think I have anything that I wait in line like that for.
Yeah, I mean, you don't even like going to the movies.
No. Certainly not going to wait. Because if I had to wait in line for a movie, that means it's a crowded movie and I'm going to be extra angry.
Yeah, you kind of do have to make that gamble. But yeah, you don't see much stuff like opening weekend.
No.
Can you think of what's the last?
I watched after it had been out like a week, I think. And then I was like, oh, that's enough time. I got to go.
Yeah, this weekend Avengers came out. Well, I guess like earlier in the week. But I know that I'm not going to have a good time if it's just like wall to wall. So I'll try and see it off hours. But anyway, this is about that. But we're talking about music and movies. So when it comes to music and movies, I always think back. I had not a traumatic experience, but a kind of upsetting moment in a film class back when I was in art school. And the teacher was really sensitive about using music to as a shorthand to sort of do the work for you as far as like establishing tone.
Okay.
And I can appreciate that. Like it certainly can be the sign of like a lazy filmmaker who relies on, you know, overbearing music to set the tone.
Sure.
But that said, like, I love music too much to, like, to not want it present. I think my favorite pieces of music are the ones that kind of call attention to themselves.
It depends, right? So sometimes there's calling attention to yourself in a Mickey Mouse kind of way where it's just, like, some guy, you know, just got killed and then they start playing "Hey Man, Nice Shot" or something. Right. Like that's too much. Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah,
with that.
Your mom talked about the Mickey Mouse effect in terms of the Lost Boys, and they're showing us like Runaways on the streets of Santa Cruz playing "The Doors, People Are Strange."
Right, it's right. Like, to me,
we
like,
get it.
That's a little too much. But I love a good soundtrack, right? As long as it's enhancing it. I mean, that's anything though in art or in life. It's not to draw attention to itself. It's to enhance it. Yeah.
Yeah, you're a big fan of like the like jukebox style.
I am.
Movie like Fright Night's a standout.
Because I used to want to do like I thought, oh, that's what I want to do with my life as a little kid. I thought like I would love to pick out songs for soundtracks. That would be cool. I still think I'd be really freaking good at it. I think that's maybe why I'm such like so into my spin instruction.
Oh yeah.
Cuz I get to play DJ for 45 minutes. I get to like everyone has to listen to my mixtape.
Oh, we should definitely shout that out for the moment. So you just got a new gig. You're at, is it Swerve Fitness?
It is Swerve. Swerve Fitness.
If you're in the New York area and you're interested in a spin class, seek out Mindy. She posts on Instagram a bunch. She gives class times and I'll get there eventually.
You'll like it. You'll like it.
I'm sure I will. I'll go for the music.
The music is good. I'm playing the brand new Perfect Circle and I'm obsessed with it right now.
Oh, cool. Wow. That's hip. That's brand new.
Yeah, brand new. Anyway, I digress. Anyway, back onto our subject.
Yeah, well, let's kind of start at the beginning.
So the very first music that was specifically written and used for a motion picture comes in 1908, Camille Saint-Saëns is the composer, and he composed music for The Assassination of the Duke of Guise. And so that became the very first time we had ever heard that. Usually before, there was program pieces, and they would play that over silent film. That's usually what you would hear. And it was stuff that was previously written, and they said, this makes the scene better. And that's how they did it that way. So in 1908, Camille Saint-Saëns, first person who does it. Why, Darren, does that name sound so familiar?
Because he wrote our namesake. The Rance Macabre is a take on the Dance Macabre.
You made that sound so boring. It should be more exciting.
Yeah, no, we were talking earlier that a lot of people don't realize that our name is a take on the Dance Macabre.
Right.
The famous piece of classical music that starts every episode.
Yes, exactly. Written by Saint-Saëns. Now, here's the kind of cool thing. Saint-Saëns is a guy who really composed around this turn of the century. He died in the 20s. I associate him with people like Debussy, stuff like that, because Debussy, huge writer in what we call program music. Program music was music that was written that was meant to elicit or paint specific pictures.
Okay.
So he's saying like, okay, well, here in the left hand, you hear some arpeggiation. That's meant to be the waves in something. Here you'll hear the moonlight coming down, and you'll hear some different things like that. And the program piece was specifically meant to invoke very specific scenes. So in a way, like, I think of program music as the first soundtrack. And the composer would give you this program, so it's not left to interpretation. It is this.
Oh, okay.
It's exactly what the composer had wanted. I think one of the most famous program pieces that many people can really interpret and hear and actually hear what's going on is Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. I don't know if you've ever heard that.
I think I've heard the title.
Yeah, so there's a lot. There's quite a few parts of it. There's about 15 parts of it. You might have heard the Baba Yaga. It's the hut on a hen's legs. And it invokes this image of the Baba Yaga tail.
Okay.
The most famous of them is the Great Gates of Kiev. That's the one. It's very broad, and I'll drop the music in and you'll say, oh, I've heard that before. And Mussorgsky had specific imagery in mind. And I think something that a lot of people, when they go to classical music, either they feel overwhelmed, like to see classical music, they feel overwhelmed or confused. People always forget to read the program. Read the program, guys. If you are new to classical music, it seems obvious, but read the program. See what the composer wanted you to think, or maybe if the composer didn't want you to think, but read the program.
It's interesting that the trend where there will be public performances of like the entire soundtrack to Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. Like they did that Radiohead Music Hall a couple of years ago. And I guess more commonly independent artists will do like a showing of like Nosferatu and do like an original score.
Yep.
And those can be really fun. I guess I've seen the version of like, you know, organ music played along mm-hmm. to it. And I guess movies like Nosferatu kind of lend themselves to that because there was never any original music
right.
for it. It was always sort of applied to it.
Right.
Yeah.
And you find that even later on into to the first Dracula, to 31, you hear the Romeo and Juliet theme is in that Dracula. It wasn't written for it, obviously. Gounod wrote that way before, but it's kind of neat to see it in there because it was a song that was familiar to people's ears that's romance.
Gotcha, yeah. What was the other? Oh, well, I guess on that note, as far as like the very early on in this podcast, we did Dracula, the 31 Dracula, but we did it specifically with the Philip Glass score.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I feel like it carried a lot of weight for that original film when we watched it in terms of like our enjoyment of it. Because certainly the original Universal films, the orchestration for those, and it is just kind of the technology of the time where, like, you're not getting high fidelity recordings to begin with, and so there's really, like, there's not a lot of breathing room at points where it's almost like distorted. It's just like this massive amount of orchestral music that sometimes is even hard to, like, pick out elements, especially when it's overlapped with dialogue, and so it can be a little burdensome. But yeah, the Philip Glass score, I think I've used that music throughout the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah. Philip Glass is one where it's hit or miss, but that one is a hit, right? It's so good. And I think that's what it speaks to, though, how important movie music is, because it can make or break a film.
Yeah. I remember, this is a throwback to our Patreon episode on cannibalism. I think we were talking about the movie Ravenous. Mm-hmm. And is it Damien Auburn? I don't, the guy from Blur did the soundtrack to that. And, like, it's bits and pieces from different places. It's peculiar orchestration.
Makes sense. There's a soundtrack that draws attention to itself solely to be like, look at me over here.
Yeah.
Like an obnoxious toddler.
I kind of like it. I like it. And no, you know what? I like a couple of the pieces a lot. If memory serves, it is a big favorite of Sean from Miskatonic Musings.
Well, I know. Maybe we'll bring it up when we go on our victory tour over there.
Throw it in
his
face.
Always the villain with those guys anyway, so just throw that on the pile.
What was the other? Oh, I guess Philip Glass also did Candyman. He did the soundtrack to that. Well, score to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think they just reused the score in Candyman too. But yeah, I don't know. I feel bad for a composer when, like, they're certainly signing away all the rights to the music at that point, and then it just gets reused and reused again.
Yeah, but that was at a time in Philip Glass's career where he was doing a lot of popular things just for the sake of doing popular things, I think. So he was just like, yeah, Candyman, that sounds great. Let's do it. You know, because for every Candyman soundtrack, you know, which, I mean, now I think I would consider it to be successful I don't think it was a successful movie at the time, but now I think it's got a good place in horror history. Every one of those, you got an Einstein on the Beach, which is his, like, 20-hour opera thing where people come and go. It's the most bizarre thing ever.
Yikes.
And then people just count and move chairs around the stage. It's very irritating. So it's like Candyman, Einstein on the Beach.
The 8. So it's 62.
You.
59.
So this episode, we're just kind of going over some people you should know, being rather broad here.
Yeah, a couple favorites.
Yeah, a person we've talked about before when we first did our Hammer episode, our Hammer Films episode.
Two-parter.
Yes, is Elizabeth Lutyens, who's an English composer. She composed a lot of stuff and recorded at the BBC, and that's how she gets involved with Hammer Films. What's awesome about her, number one, female horror film composer.
Yeah, like in residency.
Not often heard of.
No, still to this day, there's not great representation. I'm trying to, of all the, like, names I've got in front of me, there's no women.
Yeah, no, you don't really see that a lot. And what's also great about her is not only this film composer who has tons and tons of films under her belt, it was mostly avant-garde music, which, especially in avant-garde, like, high art music, you don't hear a lot of women. She was a disciple of Schoenberg, so it kind of tells you, okay, this is some 12-tone shenanigans.
Oh, okay.
And it is, but not only did she explore 12-tone, not in the same exact style as Schoenberg, she made up her own sequences, which is very cool and very high, crazy thinking.
That sounds like it would be unsettling to hear.
It's just, I mean, if I would put it bluntly, it's kind of nonsense, but it's not. There's such organization to the nonsense. It's amazing. But she not only did 12-tone, she also developed a 14-tone row. And you hear it in these movies. These are, I'm going to be blunt, some of these Hammer films are garbage. Garbage films. But the music is so intellectual and high art behind it. It's insane. It's insane, really.
Do you think, like, because they were I don't know, Hammer was sort of ran the gamut between like Curse of Frankenstein, Horror of Dracula. Those are more formulaic. At the time, there were certainly, you know, some next level shock and gore, certainly for like 58 and following. It's interesting that they started taking risks and sort of inviting an avant-garde musician to score their weirdness. Yeah.
It's just interesting to see such really intellectual high art music with such a blatant, like, red boobs, blood. You know what I'm saying? Which seems so very low.
Yeah. That, no, I have a number of thoughts running through my mind, but like Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead is, I don't know that I would call his stuff avant-garde, but it is, I don't know. It's distinct, and he's never scoring for horror, but I've used Johnny Greenwood's material on the show because even though he was writing the score for There Will Be Blood, like the content itself speaks to like horror themes and sort of, you know, certainly like sort of intimidating momentums and rhythms and things like that. But yeah, I thought we'd go from there to talking about a couple like pairings between filmmakers and musicians. So kind of jumping over, just hopscotching over just Spielberg telling, and John Williams.
Right.
Because, you know, Jaws theme, you know, you don't need to hear us talk about the Jaws theme. Everybody's gone over it 1,000 times.
But it is important that, you know these names, because we'll be talking about it next episode as well. So, like, familiarize yourself with some of these people.
Yeah, so Howard Shore and David Cronenberg are an interesting combo. Two Canadian fellows, and they certainly found themselves in those circles. And it's funny that, like, Howard Shore, Lord of the Rings, et cetera, like, big, like, orchestral giant pieces, but, like, getting his start with, like, just scoring The Brood and Scanners and Videodrome and Dead Ringers and The Fly. Like, they worked together a ton, and they still do. And then Cronenberg's later History of Violence and Eastern Promises-type movies. But it's kind of awesome that like they're still speaking the same weirdo language between them, and they find commonalities in their partnerships.
Where you have in The Exorcist that they fired the first composer because they were not speaking the same language. So it's hard to find, I think, someone who sees the same vision as you.
Yeah, and incredibly rare that like you. Like you grow together rather than like growing apart, or you know, like Howard Shore scored David Fincher's first few films.
That makes sense.
Yeah,
the Cronenberg Fincher tie, I could see that.
I could see that tonally.
Everyone would get along.
Yeah, I think for Seven, the tone is almost like David Fincher was like, "Give me something Nine Inch Nails sounding." And so, like, there are remixes of, I think the opening credits is, like, a remix of Nine Inch Nails. But otherwise, like, it's kind of going there. But it's not a coincidence that David Fincher wound up working with Trent Reznor on his later films. And it seems like that's a new pairing, given not horror, but still, like, David Fincher's moved on. Howard Shore did Panic Room, The Game, Seven. And from there, David Fincher started working with Trent Reznor. And I think The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was the first of those. And as much as I love movie soundtracks, I don't know, I have mixed feelings. Like, I like to listen to them while I'm reading, because it's kind of, you know, without voices to distract, there's no lyrics, you can just kind of, like, let it play atmosphere, especially if you're reading something good and creepy.
Like I don't listen to music like that.
No?
No, I almost said I don't read. That's not true. but I don't listen, because I actively listen so much, it's very hard for me to just...
Wow, you've got a very different relationship with music.
Yeah, it's like really difficult to just listen to atmosphere music, but I know a lot of people love to put on a soundtrack.
Are you in silence when you're reading?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
My apartment's too loud for that.
No, total silence. I must be paying attention. Speaking of Trent Reznor... He himself now does a lot of scoring, but he himself in some of his Nine Inch Nails stuff took from Tetsuo, which is amazing. And he used the same tone sequence as Tetsuo, which is a nine tone sequence in that song. And you can go to our second episode of that?
It's the first episode of our Japanese horror. It was, yeah, very strangely sort of wedged in. Tetsuo the Bullet... Wait, no. In that one, it's Tetsuo the Iron Man.
Yeah.
Right? The Bullet Man's the sequel.
Right.
Yeah.
Actually, he was the Iron Man in this one.
Right.
Because he turned to
Trent
rust.
Reznor contributed, I think, the closing theme to the second one. So, like, there's definitely a relationship there.
Yes, because he ripped off the first one. And then he was like, by the way, guys, I ripped this off. Do you also want this thing that I already copied from you?
Sorry, thanks.
I'll help you out.
So in the Trent Reznor family, a movie that's been on my radar, and I eventually did watch it, but it was brought on my radar because you said the movie was terrible.
Yes.
The soundtrack, however, the score was very good.
Very good.
And it was James Wan's Dead Silent.
Yes. Dead Silence.
Dead Silence? Okay. Yeah. The puppet movie.
Yes.
Everybody knows it as the puppet movie.
You know, I watched that in the movie theater.
Did you really?
Yes, because that's what I do with life now.
Well, this has gone back to, like, what? Like, 2010?
It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
I watched it in the movie theater.
But yeah, so the musician behind that, who, as it turns out, is a James Wan, like, partner in crime, mm-hmm. is Charlie Clauser.
Yeah. Started, I think, the first time we heard him was in Saw.
Yeah.
Was his music for Saw. He did, I think, all the Saws. How many Saws are there now? Six?
I think they just reuse his stuff.
I don't know what's going on. I haven't seen Saw in a couple episodes, or like a couple.
Yeah, I'm a couple things. Movies behind.
He also did Dead Silence, which was amazing. Resident
the music.
Evil.
Let's be specific. The music is amazing.
No, the film is terrible, right?
It's bad.
He did Resident Evil Extinction. He did the movie music for that. The Collection, which I actually enjoy The Collector and The Collection.
That? Yeah, I mean,
he
as
didn't
far
do
as
The
like,
Collector, he did Collection.
Which is the sequel.
Yeah.
Okay.
He also did Jigsaw, which did anyone see Jigsaw? Did that come out? What's going on with that? I don't know.
That came out. I don't think it's on like VOD yet, but
that came out. Also, he did the theme for American Horror Story.
Which
is hot
season?
Fire.
Because
2011.
Oh, the original.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he did the first season of American Horror Story.
Yeah.
All right, so not for nothing, but it does kind of seem like when a studio wants like a Trent Reznor Nine Inch Nails style piece of music,
he was
they
in
might
Nine
also...
Inch Nails. What are you gonna do?
He was. They toured together, so it's. I mean, it's authentic.
Yeah.
Yeah. He did a lot of the like programming and production on The Fragile and. Yeah, I mean, he's part of the family.
Yeah. Interesting side note, he worked at Manny's Music, which my husband also had worked at Manny's Music,
yeah,
which is now gone. It's a hole in the ground on 48th Street here.
Yeah, it's a real shame. 48th Street used to be like the musical center
Music
of New
Row.
York. Like, mm-hmm. You know, Manny's had such a cool wall of photographs of every musician you could think of that had come through and like... stories of Jimi Hendrix coming in after hours and just kind of being a kid in a candy shop. Yeah, that's a real shame. A pairing that you, listener, probably heard a lot without realizing it on this podcast is Tom and Andy. They are prolific. These guys never stop working. They, going back to Mothman Prophecies, they scored Mean Creek, The Hills Have Eyes, P2, The Strangers.
Yeah. They did Killing Zoe, which I love that movie.
Yeah, that's indie cred.
Yeah, right? Street cred.
They did a bunch of the Resident Evils as well. They did Citadel, the Scottish/Irish
movie. Yes, they
did. Yeah. Sinister 2, never got around to that one. The Monster, that one I liked.
I watched Sinister 2.
Yeah.
You know, because I hate those movies, but I watch them.
Those movies? There's just the two, right?
No,
you're thinking Insidious.
I'm thinking of Insidious. They're
but
the
you did
same
see Sinister
film.
2, though.
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I liked Sinister 2.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll check
I'm sorry. Out. I was thinking of Insidious, which I watch, but I hate, but I watch it.
And recently they did Wish Upon and 47 Meters Down, the Mandy Moore shark movie,
that's
which
right.
I watched and enjoyed. Come at me.
One of my favorite duos is John Murphy and Danny Boyle because those are big, freaking epic soundtracks and epic movies that use the soundtrack in a way that it's like a music video.
Yeah, we've talked about 28 Days Later kind of functioning in that way.
But also and Sunshine, he did the music for Sunshine.
Yeah, yeah. And it's such a good... So, I mean, I'm specifically thinking of Adagio in D minor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a great piece of music that it's made its way into The Walking Dead. Like, it's played over a number of different... I've seen it in commercials. Like, he's getting paid.
Yes. That song is everywhere. Also, In the House, In the Heartbeat. What is that called? Yeah.
Yeah.
In the House, In a Heartbeat. That's also, you hear that every now and then, like commercial or something like that. You're like, what is this? Oh, I like it. If I had my way with spinning, I would like play like a whole John Murphy thing. How epic would that be?
You could totally do like a horror themed like spin class.
I know.
In terms of like, you know, maybe... I know that you could go over, like, hills and inclines and things like that, but, like, in this case, like, the zombies are 10 feet away, run! Like,
we gotta go! Yeah, absolutely. I have definitely played some John Carpenter, for sure, in my classes.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I've really dug the last couple of years, he's released the Lost Themes. And so it's John Carpenter going into the studio and kind of screwing around and writing music. Yeah. Him and his son, I think his son plays drums. And so, like, John Carpenter's rocking out on synths, and they, you know, before they knew it, they had pieces of music, and they had an album, and then two albums, and a remix album, and, like, they took it to the road.
It's good. Lost Themes is great. I actually have used those songs a few times.
That's really cool.
Yeah. It's tough, though, because sometimes, like, I like the one called Wraith, but it's got this, it goes, kill me. So I try to talk over that part while people are writing, because I don't want to, like, weird out some of my... older writers, you know, they're like, what the heck?
She's like, trying to kill us.
She is. So I talk over that part. Kill
them. Okay, so to close out with John Carpenter and kind of celebrate what he's done over his career, here's a little bit of bio and kind of explanation why he, you know, wound up being the auteur that he is. This is a quote from John Carpenter. At the beginning, I was doing the music out of necessity because we had no money. At some point, I realized that the scores became another voice, another way I could further what I was doing as a filmmaker. It became an extension of directing. Composing was a lot of extra work, but I kept going as long as I could stand it, kind of like directing. So John Carpenter has written the music for his movies. I didn't realize this until doing research this time around, but he won an Oscar for his first short film, The Resurrection of Bronco Billy.
Huh. I did not know that.
I think he was still at UCLA, so he was... I mean, it's funny to think of a young John Carpenter.
It is funny, because when I was looking into his bio, he learned composition from his father.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, that's adorable to think of his dad, like, helping, like, little John Carpenter write music, and then it later grows to Kill Me, Please kind of music.
So John Howard Carpenter was born in Carthage, New York, to Mother Milton and Father Howard. His family moved to Bowling Green, Kentucky, where his father was a professor as head of the music department at Western Kentucky University. He attended Western Kentucky University and then USC Film School in Los Angeles. In 1962, he began making short films and won the Academy Award for Best Live Action Short Subject in 1970. That was for The Resurrection of Bronco Billy, which he made at USC. Carpenter formed a band in the mid-70s called the Coupe de Villes. He's a big car guy. Christine kind of speaks to that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. The band, the Coupe de Villes, includes future directors Tommy Lee Wallace and Nick Castle. For his own films, he's written the scores for Dark Star, Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween, The Fog, Escape from New York, Halloween 2, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, Christine, Big Trouble in Little China, Prince of Darkness, They Live, the TV movie Body Bags, In the Mouth of Madness, Village of the Damned, Escape from L.A., Vampires, and Ghosts of Mars. And so he's got a distinct style. He's kind of, I feel like everybody these days who's going with the synth, new wave throwback soundtracks is like, it's all an homage to John Carpenter. Robert Rodriguez has talked extensively about his love for John Carpenter, even played the soundtracks for Escape from New York on his own film sets to kind of set the mood.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's clearly where It Follows was coming from with their soundtrack. Even to an extent, even though it was found music in The Guest, it still had that kind of throwback kind of feel.
Yeah, the band Survive.
Yeah.
Is a all instrumental band that's like all synths and drums and really good stuff. I like them a lot. Yeah, I think you coined it Synth Nouveau back in the day. Yeah, so we'll leave it there on a note of adoration. Next episode, we're going to be talking about specific music and the sort of dynamics that play, and Mindy's going to break down some musical theory. We're going to kind of figure out why things scare us to hear.
We'll probably talk about tritones. I'm going to just throw that out there.
So as always, you can check us out on Patreon for a whole alternate catalog of material. We've got everything from original music, fully produced episodes. We've got a sort of true crime episode that we did with after our police horror episode. We've got all kinds of goodies over there. So check us out at patreon.com/rantsmacabre.
We are on Twitter. We are on Facebook.
And Instagram.
And Instagram. I always forget about Instagram.
All the places. Our email is therantsmacabre@gmail.com. Drop us a line. Let's hear from you guys. Everybody's definitely got... I mean, we talked about a lot of specifics today, but obviously everybody's got their favorite musical scores, and you know, we didn't talk about any of the big ones in terms of Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th. We talked a little bit about John Carpenter and Halloween, but we'll go more in depth next episode. But we want to hear from you guys. That'll do it for me. This is Darren, signing off.
This is Mindy. Thanks.
Let me speak to you about the anatomy of terror. Anatomy.
Now we are ready to begin.
Silence.
Listen. Is it to awaken and hear the passing of time? Or is it the failing beat of your own heart? Or the footsteps of someone who, just a moment before, was in your room? But let us not dwell on terror. The knowledge of terror is vouchsafed only to the precious few. Are you ready now?
Ready now.
Ready now.
Ready now.
The Neverworld, the infernal regions, the abode of the damned, the place of torment, pandemonium, Shabbat, Tophet. Gehenna, Naraka, the pit, the pit, the pit, the pit. My ultimate device of torture. Just a word. It is reality.